editor of the National Gazette receives a salary from the government. Query, whether the salary is paid him for translations or for publications, the design of which is to vilify those to whom the voice of the people has committed the administration of our public affairs. To oppose the measures of government and by false insinuations to disturb the public peace. Well, within a few months, Hamilton is in fact getting personal. And we'll look at Catalyst number 3, a very powerful essay. He'd previously written under the name The American, and he states, "The American then has justly and from sufficient data inferred that Mr. Jefferson's politics, whatever may be the motives of them, tend to national disunion, insignificance, disorder, and discredit. That the subversion of the funding system would produce national discredit proves itself. Loss of credit, the reason being the same, must attend nations as well as individuals who voluntarily and without necessity violate their formal and positive engagements." And here he's referring to Jefferson's statements he'd made in Europe about the fact that public debts may well be able to be forgotten after 19 years, and it is almost 19 years since many of these debts have been contracted. But then he gets deeply personal. "No, Mr. Jefferson has hitherto been distinguished as the quiet, modest, retiring philosopher, as the plain, simple, unambitious Republican. He shall not now for the first time be regarded as the intriguing incendiary, the aspiring, turbulent competitor. It has been pertinently remarked by a judicious writer that Caesar, who overturned the Republic, was the Whig. Cato, who died for it, the Tory of Rome. Such at least was the common cant of political harangues, the insidious tale of hypocritical demagogues." And this brings us back to that opening scene where he looks at those three portraits and says the greatest man that ever lived was Julius Caesar. He's being sarcastic. He's saying, "Your great Whig synthesis, remember who the ultimate Whig was, the ultimate popularis of Rome, was Julius Caesar. The Republicans, in fact, were the aristocrats, the elitists." And he's suggesting that, in fact, Jefferson is playing the part of Caesar. We'll see later he doesn't actually think Jefferson is Caesar. He thinks he's more like Tiberius Gracchus. Finally, angry, hurt, Jefferson appeals to Washington against Hamilton. And what he reveals in this appeal is a passionate hatred, an almost conspiratorial fear of his rival. His first approach in May of 1792 is sectional. He tells Washington, who is a Virginian after all, "Whenever northern and southern prejudices have come into conflict, the latter have been sacrificed and the former soothed, that the owners of the debt are in the southern, and the holders of it in the northern division, and that the anti-federal champions are now strengthened in argument by the fulfillment of their predictions, that this has been brought about by the monarchical federalists," those northerners, "themselves, who have been for the new government merely as a stepping stone to monarchy." But in the following month, Jefferson goes farther. He begins to try to clear himself of the charges that Hamilton had made against him. "If it has been supposed that I have ever intrigued among the members of the legislatures to defeat the plans of the Secretary of the Treasury, it is contrary to all truth." Now, it's an interesting thing. Jefferson doesn't lie, he just doesn't tell the whole story. It's true that Jefferson doesn't intrigue with the members of the House of Representatives. His partner, James Madison, does that. Jefferson doesn't have to. "That I have utterly in my private conversations disapproved of the system of the Secretary of the Treasury, I acknowledge and avow. And this was not merely a speculative difference. His system flowed from principles adverse to liberty and was calculated to undermine and demolish the Republic by creating an influence of his department over the members of this legislature." Now, this may not in fact be the case, but I want to argue Jefferson is utterly sincere. Jefferson does believe this. Then he deals with the issue of the hiring of Freneau. "The fact stands thus. While the government was at New York, I was applied to on behalf of Freneau to know if there was any place within my department which he could be appointed. So he hires him as an interpreter. I cannot recollect whether it was at that time or afterwards that I was told he had thought of setting up a newspaper there. But as to any other direction or indication of my wish how his press should be conducted, what sort of intelligence he should give, what essays encourage, I can protest in the presence of heaven that I never did by myself or any other directly or indirectly say a syllable nor attempt any kind of influence." Well, that's actually true, except that he knows exactly what Freneau is going to do. Well, I want to finish with this last quote on Hamilton, which shows the depth of his hatred. I will not suffer my retirement to be clouded by the slander of a man whose history, from the moment at which history can stoop to notice him, is a tissue of machinations against the liberty of the country which he has not only received and given him bread, but heaped its honors on his head. At the end of Washington's first term, Jefferson retires. It is a second retirement, and he claims his last.